This is the Medicast, December 27th, 2010.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters.
This is the Medicast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up. Here's today's show with the Podmedic, Jamie Davis.
Well, good day and welcome to this week's episode of the Medicast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Podmedic, and I'd like to welcome everybody to the show this week. Whether you're watching the show on a TV device or online using medicast.tv or listening to the podcast over via iTunes, whatever the case may be, I want to welcome you to the show. A lot of you are listening in right after the Christmas holiday, so I hope that your holidays were safe and went well for you and your families and you didn't have to work too much. In the meantime, I do want to remind you to make sure you check out the information available for you in the show notes for this and every other episode, along with the additional articles, links, and information you'll find every week over for you at the Medicast site. Medicast.com/blog is your resource to find additional information. And of course, all of the links and information associated with each week's episode here of the Medicast as we roll into our sixth year here on the show. We've been bringing weekly information for the emergency medical services professional via this show and on that website. So you'll want to continue to follow up there. Of course, you can sign up for the Medicast newsletter while you're there and get all of those links sent to you each week in your email inbox. And of course, you'll find links there to the Medicast on Twitter and Facebook and other places. You'll find me there under the handle Podmedic, twitter.com/podmedic, facebook.com/podmedic, and of course, the Medicast Facebook fan page at Facebook.com/MedicCast. Just click the like button right there at the top of the page to become a fan of the MedicCast on Facebook. If you want to get back in touch with me directly by email, send those emails in to podmedic@mac.com. And of course, don't forget, you can always reach me by the voicemail line, 941-306-3342, 941-30-MEDIC. Call in on the voicemail line, share your thoughts and ideas directly with the listeners here on the MedicCast using the MedicCast voicemail line. And I love to hear from each and every one of you. And no matter how you contact me, I do try to make sure I respond back to you in some way, either here directly on the show or by responding back to you by email. So continue to keep in touch with me. I love to hear from you with your ideas, your thoughts, and corrections even. If you have anything that I need to change that I may have misspoken about, all of that is part of the process here on the MedicCast. Let's jump in and check in with a few listener emails that I got, and just want to check back in with you. One of the things I heard recently from a listener who'd unsubscribed from the Medicast email newsletter, and you know, you can unsubscribe anytime you want. There's always a link at the bottom of the page to unsubscribe when you get those emails in. So if you need to do so, certainly do so. There'll always be an opportunity for you to comment why you unsubscribed. And one of the recent unsubscribed listeners was checking in and letting me know that he didn't like the fact there was advertising on the MedicCast. I'm sorry that he feels that way, and we'll wish him luck no matter what in his future endeavors. But, you know, I have camera equipment and studio equipment, and we go on trips to go to different conferences and bring that information to you here, and that doesn't happen for free. We need to have some level of sponsorship and advertising here on the show. Now, I don't make it something that is like TV or radio where you get, you know, 15 minutes of a TV show and 15 minutes of commercials, but you know, in a 45-minute episode here of the MedicCast, maybe you're going to have 3 or 4 minutes of advertising over the course of some time. Sometimes there may not be any ads in the shows if we don't have an advertiser at that time. But if we do have an advertiser, I would ask you, you get this show for free, take a few moments out of your day and just visit the advertiser sites. I usually provide some specific link. I often try to get them to give you some kind of special bonus, whether it's a free trial or a discount, but check out those links. Just visiting that link, even if you don't purchase anything, does track back and let them know that you are caring about the fact that they are advertising on the show and following up on that. And those advertisements, you know, those sponsors help to pay for the next conference that I go to and where I'm able to bring you live material from things like EMS Expo or EMS Today or other conferences. So if you, you know, if you want to continue to receive the Medicast absolutely free, we need to be able to pay for the bills there somehow. And so I do appreciate you bearing with me on that. And if that's a deal breaker for you, hey, you know, we can part ways. It's okay. But I do want to just let you know that there will be advertising from time to time here on the Medicast. And you just you can always fast forward to get past the advertising if that's something you want to do. But it will be there occasionally. And it's just something that we need to do to be able to pay the bills. In any case, I do want to thank you all for checking out the show, even if it's one or two times, because it's important for me to make sure that the information we provide here gets out to the EMS community. Whether you find it via the Medicast or via another website, it's important that we work together to make sure that the best possible information gets out to the members of the EMS community, the EMTs, paramedics, students, and instructors out there. So we'll continue to do that here. Did hear from numerous of the EMS podcasters over the weekend. We wished each other back and forth happy holidays. And I would just take this opportunity to remind you that there are lots of other programs out there. So if you don't like something the way I do a show, you might want to check out some of the other great podcasts out there. You can find a lot of them over at the ProMed Network. That's a conglomeration of independent medical and healthcare related programs, including a lot of great EMS shows, shows like Rick Rosati's Mitigation Journal, Chris Montero's EMS Garage podcast, Greg Free's EMS Educast. We have Jim Huffman's podcasts over there, Authorized Transmissions, and some of the other great shows like the new, brand new PDU, the Pediatric University show that deals with EMS pediatric treatment and assessment. So there's a lot of great stuff out there, and I would urge you to follow up and track what's going on in those other shows. And just thanks to all of the great EMS podcasters, this community has become very strong over the last year, and I just am very excited about what 2011 is going to hold for myself and the other EMS podcasters. So let's continue to support them and check out their programs. Let's jump on in and look at this week's news items, and I'll start off with a story that's coming out of New York City, and this is a look at the heated discussion and story that happened in relation to the pregnant woman who died in New York City while there were EMTs or paramedics that had been getting coffee at a coffee shop right next door or adjacent to where that woman had collapsed. And these EMTs are facing various levels of scrutiny associated with whether or not they had a duty to act in treating these patients. Now, these were EMT dispatchers from a dispatch center that was located in an office in the building above this coffee shop. And so were they clinically field-trained EMTs, or were they dispatchers? Both EMTs involved did pass along that they should call 911 and have an actual dispatch unit. What were these people going to be able to do with no equipment of their own with them? It's not like they had an ambulance parked out front. So there's a lot of misunderstandings about what's going on here. Rather than second guess what's going on with these particular EMTs and what's going through their brains, I mean, they're involved in the court process now and they'll have to deal with those issues. They have attorneys and representation to do that. But as often is the case, I like to look at stories like this and take from it a lesson that we might be able to apply to our own areas or scope of practice. And one of the things that I see in this type of story is that we need to understand specifically what our services require of us when we are on or off duty, what they require of us or what our states and locations require of us when we have our certifications or licenses, and what is our duty to act in a given situation. This is something that you should be pulling together a training resource for your area. So if you're a training officer listening to this, or you know the training officer in your system, say, hey, you know what? We'd like to maybe review this particular story and our duty to act. How do you want us to respond in a similar situation with regards to our job? And the reason you do this is if there's a piece of training out there, if there's an official response to when this happens, you should do this, it may protect you when you follow those guidelines for response. And I think that this is something that is often overlooked. You know, we get that brief, chapter of medico-legal issues where they talk about duty to act and negligence and abandonment and all of those other issues that we can be sued for, we can be liable for, but how does that apply to our actual patient care? And what are those rules and how do they apply to our own specific job responsibilities? Does a dispatcher who's also an EMT have a duty to act that is the same as an EMT and paramedic that rides on the street every day? Those rules may be different in different places. And so that's the lesson I take from this is, how do these things apply specifically to you? And maybe this is an opportunity for you to get some specific guidance and training on exactly how duty to act works within your specific system, whether it's volunteer or paid, commercial or third service, whatever the case may be. There are going to be different rules that apply differently in both your service and based upon your state and local rules, laws, and regulations. So this is an opportunity for us all to learn. Next up is an interesting article I found over at CNN Health, and it looks at, you're going to look at the title of this article and go, why is he putting that in here? It's 5 immunity-boosting tips for moms. Well, okay, some of you that are listening to this are moms or dads, and so there are immunity-boosting tips here, but there are some good ideas in here as we are in the midst of the flu season. First of all, you should have all had your flu shots, right? Because you should be on the top of the list to get flu shots as a medical professional dealing with the patient population. But on top of that, you don't want to be bringing things home with you to your families and your loved ones. So anything you can do to boost your immunity, your immune system, is going to help you stay healthier and consequently help the people around you, your partners, your family members, your loved ones, whether it's at work or at home, keep everyone healthier. So there's some good tips in this article. Of course, the first tip is keep your baby close. That's not going to apply to most of us. But then the rest of them are really good ideas. Be friendly. You know, keeping your mood elevated and being positive in your outlook on things can do a lot to boost your immune system. Naps aren't just for kids. Fatigue is a huge sapper of your immune system. For those of you that are working 24-hour shift systems and you're busy as all get out, you need to find ways to get naps whenever you can. And I would urge you to, you know, develop the habit of the power nap so that you can be rested in between calls as much as possible. These will boost your immune system as well, getting enough sleep. Make sure you're washing appropriately and frequently before, during, and after patient contact so that you are keeping your hands clean as possible. Avoid touching your face, your mouth, your eyes to transmit diseases. Viruses just love to get in contact with your mucous membranes. So try to avoid touching yourself in your face, your hands, your eyes, and then washing your hands frequently will all keep you safer. And then music, rocking out. You know, anything that can elevate your mood can affect your immune system in a positive way. So listening to positive music, listening to something that you enjoy and can lift you up a little bit is going to improve your immune system. So be prepared. You know, if you have your MP3 player handy, you listen to songs in between while you're cleaning out the ambulance, putting on the radio and listening to music while you're getting your ambulance set up for the next call. All of these things can go a long way towards elevating your mood and consequently, increasing your immune system response when you come in contact with things. So it's a great article. I mean, I think we need to look outside the lines for some of these tips. And this is a great example of a good set of tips to boost your immune system that you might not look at as a medical professional or an EMT, paramedic, whoever. There's some good tips built in there that can affect all of us. So I would urge you to do that. Finally, the last news item in the show this week is looking at a new study that's come out looking at a a more sensitive troponin cardiac marker test. And what has been found is that by using this more sensitive troponin test, they're able to actually identify levels of the protein much more rapidly in the system. And because of this, they can actually identify patients with cardiac issues prior to them having an MI. Yeah, that's right. I mean, we all know troponin as that primary cardiac marker that is looked for prior to a patient or after a patient has already had an MI. We may not see ST elevation, so we send them to the hospital. They get blood work done. And part of that blood work process is to look at troponin levels and other cardiac muscle damage markers. And then if they see them, we can say, oh, this guy has a level of this much, and we're going to go ahead and say that they've had an MI. And it hasn't shown up as ST elevation yet, but we do have cardiac markers. This new, more sensitive test actually can identify lower levels of damage to the cardiac muscle that releases troponin into the system, but these markers are identified at a much more dilute level, and so we can identify patients at the beginning stages of congestive heart failure, for instance. So when the heart starts to become enlarged, we can sometimes stave off some of these problems when we identify these patients. And so you may start seeing these types of tests showing up in your hospital systems, and a lot of you are associated with hospital systems, where you may be looking at patients' charts as you're transporting them between facilities. You should identify that this is something that perhaps this has been used to identify them as having a cardiac issue. The other side of this is, I really don't think we're that far away from having some sort of a mini lab on board our ambulances. And because of that, we may be starting to identify some of these problems in the field and making transport decisions because of them. So as we continue to add new and innovative monitoring equipment to our ambulances, I think you'll find that we are also going to be adding some new tools and assessment ideas to our kits and our thought process. And this is something that you should keep in the back of your mind, because it may well show up as something you use in the similar way we test for blood sugar levels. Now, you might be getting a little bit of blood and putting it on a slide and dropping it into a machine, and it pops out a whole level of cardiac markers for you to track and send through your system. By the way, I just wanted to let you know, I'm working on a new podcast over the last several months. It's sponsored by Physio-Control, but it's about innovations in patient care technology and assessment. And we've talked about things like this in the past, and you might want to check that show out. You can find it in iTunes. It's listed in Innovations in Patient Care. And I bring on other people like Tom Boothelet from Pre-Hospital 12 Lead blog. We also talk to people like Peter Canning from the his very popular blog available, and MedicScribe blog. So, plus some medical professionals at all levels that we meet at different conferences. So I'm really excited that we have this out there, and you might want to check that show out. It's about 20 to 25 minutes a couple times a month, and again, it talks specifically about new technologies and ways that we use existing technologies to assess and care for our patients. And again, it's called Innovations in Patient Care. That's it for the news this week. Remember, you can follow up on the links to these news items, whether you get the newsletter or perhaps you just are checking out the site at medicast.com/blog. Share these news items, discuss them in between yourself and your partner, your colleagues, whoever you may run into. These are great discussion points. And again, I think all of these items will help improve your patient care and help you continue on to providing the best care possible for your patients as an emergency medical services professional. Time now for this week's tip of the week, and this is a pre-recorded segment. It's an audio segment, but I did put together a PowerPoint to go with it, so there'll be some video if you're watching the video version of this. And this is an interview that I did with Lisa Booz from the Maryland Poison Center, another one of our Tox Tidbits segments with her. And this week we're talking about toxic or not, some of those things out there that may or may not be thought to be toxic when they actually aren't. So these are some of the toxicology myths and things that she brought up for us at this time of year for us to review here on the MedicCast.
Hi, this is Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and it's that time of the month. We must be back with Lisa Booz from the Maryland Poison Center. And Lisa, you sent me a little heads up on this topic. We're going to be talking about things that we think are toxic but actually aren't. Is that correct?
That's exactly right. I just thought I'd do something a little different and talk about some household products that most people would think that they'd be very toxic if children eat them, but surprisingly they aren't. And it's important to be aware of some of these products because poison centers get many calls from parents about children who ingest or swallow these products, and also because they're perceived to be very toxic, parents can call 911 because they're concerned about it, or they rush their child into the emergency department. Hopefully they call the poison center first so we keep them from doing that, but sometimes the exposures that you're dealing with are actually non-toxic exposures. So I thought we'd go through some of the ones that we get calls about. First, mercury thermometers. Now, mercury thermometers have been banned from being sold for environmental reasons, but many homes still have these fever thermometers that contain the silver liquid like mercury. When they're used to take the temperature of a small child, or if the child happens to find the thermometer and is sort of playing around with it, kids often bite the thermometers in half and they break them. So frantic parents then call poison centers because they have no way of knowing whether any of the mercury has been swallowed. Well, you don't have to worry about that. The silver elemental mercury that's in old thermometers is not absorbed when swallowed. It just kind of passes through. There are other types of mercury that are very toxic, but not the silver elemental mercury that's in a thermometer. The only way that that mercury is toxic in most cases is if a significant amount of the mercury is left laying around, maybe on a heat source like a radiator or a stove, and it evaporates and then people inhale the vapors. But swallowing that silver mercury is not a problem. It's not toxic. Next is silica gel. Now, silica gel is what's in those little packets that you find in shoeboxes and vitamin bottles, among other types of products. It's actually a desiccant. In other words, it absorbs moisture, and that's why it's put in these products. Children frequently find these products, these little packets. They break them open, and they swallow some of the little granules or the beads that are inside. We get a lot of calls from parents that are very upset over this because the packets traditionally say do not eat on them, or they'll have a skull and crossbones, or they'll have some other warning on there that might indicate to the parent that it's very toxic or highly toxic. But it really isn't. Fortunately, despite all the warnings, silica gel is harmless. Poison centers also receive phone calls about kids who get into mom's birth control pills. Oral contraceptives are not toxic in one-time overdoses, even with many tablets, unless the pills also contain iron. There are some birth control pills out there that contain iron in them. Sometimes they'll cause an upset stomach, but really nothing other than that. Now, if a child ingests birth control pills chronically, in other words, over days or weeks or months, that can be toxic. But it's really rare to hear of a case of a child that eats birth control pills every day for days or months. So, 99.9% of the cases that we hear about, we consider to be non-toxic because they're acute exposures. Corticosteroids like prednisone are also not toxic in one-time doses in kids. Prednisone is found in homes fairly often because there are other family members that might be taking them for arthritis or for poison ivy, among other medical conditions. Fortunately, they're safe even in very large amounts. The exception, once again, would be if a child ingests the tablets every day for weeks or months, but acute ingestions are really no problem. A common product found in many homes, especially homes with children, is petroleum jelly. Vaseline is the most common brand name, but it's sold under other brand names and generic names. It's not toxic when it's ingested. It can be a problem if aspirated because it is a petroleum distillate product, but it's so thick that it usually is not aspirated. It's very difficult to aspirate something that's thick like that. We think of aspiration pneumonia from substances like gasoline and kerosene and lighter fluid, more substances that are not very viscous or thick. Who would think that rat poisons are not toxic when eaten by humans? But it's true. Many rat poisons contain anticoagulants, very similar to warfarin, but they're actually more potent and longer acting. But there's very little of the anticoagulant rat poison that's coated on the little granules or beads or pellets. Even so, even though it's long acting and even so it's more potent, it really takes a large, large amount of these pellets to cause the anticoagulant effect in children. And in most cases, if not all cases, that would be more than what a child would be able to eat in one sitting. Poinsettias get a pretty bad rap around Christmas time. They're thought to be toxic by many people, and they're often banned from areas where there are children or elderly who are likely to eat part of the plant, places like daycare centers and nursing homes. But in fact, poinsettias are not toxic, and if a large amount of the plant is eaten, there might be a little bit of nausea and maybe even vomiting that would occur, but that's it. Toothpaste tubes, if you pick up your toothpaste tube in your home, there's clearly a warning on there that the toothpaste may be harmful or fatal if swallowed. Small children who are learning to brush their teeth often swallow a small amount that was on the toothbrush, and that's not enough to be toxic. But not only that, even if a small child ingests most, if not all, of the toothpaste in the whole tube, there's not enough fluoride or other ingredients in there to cause anything other than GI upset or nausea, vomiting. Now, bleach, we get a lot of phone calls about bleach ingestions in children. People who do laundry often pour their household bleach into a cup before adding it to the washer. And then the child, who's very curious, comes along, picks up the cup, and drinks from it. Household bleach contains sodium hypochlorite, but it's in a concentration that's dilute enough that swallowing a few mouthfuls or so, or even a cupful, will often cause vomiting, but it won't cause any other toxic effects. Now, industrial bleaches are different, so I don't want people to be confused about that, but we're talking about the household laundry bleach like Clorox or other brands that you can buy in the grocery store or other stores. Some other household items that are readily available to children but considered to be safe if ingested include pencil lead. It's really not lead, it's graphite, even though we call it pencil lead. Dish detergent, which usually causes vomiting, but nothing more than that. Poster paints, watercolors, chalk, crayons, calamine lotion, the ink from ballpoint pens and felt tip markers, Play-Doh is non-toxic, sunscreens, shave cream, and most cosmetics. And the list really could go on. There are many other products in the home that are non-toxic if children eat them. So even though you suspect maybe that the patient that you're seeing has ingested a product that's non-toxic, it's always best to call the poison center to check to be sure that no treatment is needed. As a reminder, the 24-hour poison center telephone number is 1-800-222-1222.
And that's a good point, Lisa. There's just so many things. I mean, we could keep going probably on this topic for quite some time, but it's simple enough to call that phone number and get a hold of the local poison center, either as a medical professional calling for a patient or advising patients that number is available and having parents call directly.
That's right. Again, there are some things that you would think would be quite toxic, and they're not. On the other hand, there are also things that you think would be non-toxic, and they can be toxic. So, it can be quite confusing, and the best place to call is the local poison center. And we do like to promote that the public call us, parents call us before calling 911 or before taking their child into the emergency department, because often it's unnecessary, such as in these cases. So we can save a lot of healthcare resources by them calling the poison center and us advising them that they don't need to seek any medical treatment, or we might offer a little bit of treatment recommendations that can be handled right there at home.
Fantastic. Well, Lisa, as always, it's great to have you here on the show, and you're a wonderful resource for the audience here.
Thanks, Jamie. I appreciate that.
And that's going to wrap up this week's episode of the MedicCast. I do want to remind you to follow up on the links in the show notes for this week's tip item and make sure you check out all of those links and apply the information you find there to your own scope of practice and your instructional guidelines. So I can promote and provide information here to you for 10 or 15 minutes in a tip segment, but it's really your job to take the additional information, your own scope of practice, protocols, and information, and figure out how you apply it specifically to what you are allowed to do where you are working or operating as a student, whatever the case may be. If you'd like to find additional information, again, their show notes are available at mediccast.com/blog. Again, you find the show notes link at the top of the page, and you can find all of the news links and tip links from this week's episode. If you'd like to get back in touch with me, of course, you can always leave a comment right there on any of the articles or pages over at the MedicCast site, or you can send me an email. Send those emails in to podmedic@mac.com. I love to hear from each and every one of you, and I look forward to getting those emails in. I will respond back to you. I try very hard to make sure I respond back to all the emails I get. Might take me a few days, but I will get back to you. And of course, don't forget, you can always call in on the voicemail line, 941-306-3342, 941-30-MEDIC. You can also reach me via Twitter and Facebook under the handle PodMedic, twitter.com/PodMedic or facebook.com/PodMedic, and become a fan now of the MedicCast Facebook fan page, where I post questions and ideas and ask you what you'd like to see in future episodes when you become a member of that fan page over there. Over 2,000 fans already and growing all the time, so go ahead and visit facebook.com/MedicCast, click the like button right there at the top of the page, and become a fan here of the MedicCast on Facebook. We're going to go ahead and close out the show with our final holiday-themed song for the year. I know we're in January, but as we wrap up the holiday weekend and come out of New Year's, I thought it would be a good time to play this last song from the band called Basic, and this is their song, God Rest Ye Merry Gentlemen. I hope you enjoy. It's a rocked-out version of that song, and we'll be getting into our regular PodSafe music selections next week on the show. And in the meantime, don't forget to check out the information here on the show, follow up on the things here on the MedicCast, and most importantly, remember to stay safe and stay tuned here to the MedicCast, and remember, scene safety, BSI.
This is Natalie Brown wishing you a very safe and happy holiday season.
In one horse open sleigh.